In this episode of Emerge, I'm speaking with Stephen Reed. Stephen Reed and his co-conspirators at the UK Psychedelic Society are pioneering a contemporary reimagining of the ancient art of facilitating transformational experiences using entheogenic substances. In this episode, Stephen and I discuss metamodernism, psychedelics, of course, and what we're going to do with all these empty churches. Please enjoy this episode of Emerge. All right, welcome to another episode of Emerge. This week, my guest, my conversational partner is Stephen Reed. Stephen, welcome to Emerge.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great, yeah. And so Stephen and I met each other, I think originally because I reached out to you because you were kind of stewarding this project called the Meta Monastery, right? And it was this kind of coming together of metamodernism, which is this sort of, we'll say for now, political philosophy, political movement, and new kind of co-living situations. And I was really interested in that at the time. I've spent time in monasteries, so I was really excited to find perhaps like the one other person on the planet who's like looking at monasteries and metamodernism. I was like, oh, wow, okay, you know, this person, you know, is clearly where we should speak to each other. And, you know, we had a really sweet conversation after that. We've been kind of just talking and sending each other messages, and it feels like we're sort of syncing up. And I think, you know, we thought we'd have a kind of open-ended conversation that will hover around generally the topic of psychedelics and this kind of emerging paradigm. I think, you know, often it's referred to that we're going through a kind of renaissance of psychedelics, and maybe we can talk a little bit about that, set the context. But, you know, let's just have fun together. Let's just have a real conversation and see what comes out of it.
Sounds great. Yeah, I think that's I would have given a similar background to the way that we met. And I just add that I've been listening to the podcast, and it's quickly become one of my favorites. I'm really getting a lot out of it, and I'm really enjoying just the kind of the authenticity of it, and the sense that you really are managing to draw people into this this space of newness. Actually, it rarely feels rehearsed. It feels like people are kind of really, you know, thinking and working things out as they go, and I've been appreciating that.
Yeah, beautiful, and I feel pleasant sensations all over my body hearing you say that, you know, because it sounds like, yeah, you kind of get what we're trying to do or what I'm trying to do. And I feel like, you know, we're very much on that same wavelength, right? You kind of get it in a really interesting way. And you're also in this metamodern community. And yeah, well, first, maybe give yourself a little bit of an introduction for people, you know, that are listening. Like, where are you coming from? Where are you in the world? Let's just situate you.
Yeah, sure. So I grew up in London in the UK with a pretty happy and stable childhood family life. I went to university to study physics. And whilst I was at university, both of my parents died within 3 months of each other from unrelated causes. So that was a very turbulent time in my life, but I certainly learned a lot from it and continue to learn a lot from it. I went on to do a master's in complexity sciences and had funding to do a PhD, but decided not to at the last minute and instead went to live in France. And when I came back to the UK, I got heavily involved in the climate movement with a group called Climate Camp that were Each summer they would set up a camp at a piece of polluting infrastructure and shut it down for a week at a time or something like this. And that was my first taste of the world of activism and direct action, and it just blew my mind, and I made all sorts of incredible connections with people I met there. I then went on to set up a group called UK Uncut, which was taking action on austerity, the austerity program that actually still continues under this current government in the UK. And there it was also, something pretty fun and creative. We were closing down the high street stores of companies that were engaged in tax dodging, tax avoidance and evasion, using some sort of interesting and fun and colorful ways. I started working for the New Economics Foundation, an economics think tank, during that time. I left that thinking that I would start a campaign on the basic income. But in the context of thinking about the basic income and why I was interested in it, I realized that what I was really interested in was meaning and purpose. In the end, I ended up setting up the Psychedelic Society, which is the current project.
And what is the Psychedelic Society getting up to these days?
So the Psychedelic Society, we now say, believes that the conscious use of there's a bit of sound in the background there. Is that going to be a problem?
Oh, I think it's all right. Yeah, it's fine.
Yeah, fine. So we say the Psychedelic Society believes that the conscious use of psychedelics can help us bring about a more compassionate and joyful world through the healing and growth of the individual. So we're very much interested in the benefits of these substances and spreading awareness of the benefits of these substances. Of course, there's plenty of people who are aware of the risks, to a slightly absurd degree, and we run events in London and Bristol. We campaigned for the legal regulation of psychedelics in the UK, and the main event really is our main activity of the organization is running Psychedelic Experience Weekends in the Netherlands, where we take groups of 15 people at a time over to large houses in the countryside outside of Amsterdam to experience psilocybin truffles that are legal in the Netherlands. And I meant to ask you, Daniel, to remind me of your previous experience with psychedelics.
Yeah, I have had pretty substantial experience with psychedelics, mostly mushrooms, acid, and ayahuasca more recently. Actually, it was kind of the way that I found a spiritual path was through a mushrooms experience in college. And so it's been a really significant part of my development. A topic I'm totally fascinated in.
Yeah. Were you meditating at that point, or did that spark your interest in meditation and other related techniques?
It sparked it. It sparked it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It really opened my mind to that. Yeah, it wasn't really even on my radar before. Okay. None of that kind of thing.
Yeah. So, can I ask you what was your first trip, or how did you get into it if it wasn't on your radar?
And just this is to my mom, if for some reason she listens to this episode, happy to talk about this with you in person, so you don't hear about this as a broadcast or whatever, but. My first experience was I was home from college for the summer, and I don't know how it happened, but I got some mushrooms and I took it in my then girlfriend's apartment. She was gone. I was with two of my good friends and they didn't take mushrooms. So they kind of sat the trip for me, and they had the experience before and they sort of took care of me. I remember one part of the journey was going out onto the lake. My town had a lake in the middle of it, Cazenovia Lake, and just being in the middle of this lake, as I remember it, I don't know how it actually was, but as I remember it, and just being completely gobsmacked by the beauty of nature in a way that I just never even had a sense of. I think I was so locked in my head. At least that's, you know, one way I think I could explain it. But in any case, it was completely transformative, this experience of beauty and just sort of joy and like lightness, like things became less dense just for a moment, long enough for me to see that, oh, okay, there's a completely different way of being alive, you know, that is much more enjoyable, quite simply. Yeah.
I can relate to a lot of that. First.
What was it like? What was it like for you?
I was given my first pill of MDMA at Glastonbury Festival in 2011, which is this huge festival, the largest one in the UK, by one of my best friends at the time. And I was so scared. I'd never taken any sort of, you know, illegal substance before that point. And I was so scared that I actually only pretended to take the pill and then put it in my back pocket instead. And then sort of half an hour later, when all the other people that I was with seemed to be having a pretty good time, then I thought, okay, here we go. It's, you know, and it was, it was one of the most memorable evenings of my life. But over the next, and I took MDMA a few more times over the next year to 18 months, and ended up developing a strange allergy to it. And now every time I take it, it seems it makes me itch in a quite uncomfortable way. And it was actually that allergy which made me interested. So, consider what other substances are there out there? MDMA can't be the only one. And that actually got me, that was how I started reading about psychedelics. And other psychoactive substances, but decided that psychedelics sounded the most interesting next port of call. And I obtained a substance called 2CB, which is a short-acting psychedelic, and was the favorite of the famous psychedelic chemist Alexander Shulgin. And I took it at another festival. This is a year after that first MDMA experience. And MDMA is my only reference point. It did resemble that for the first half an hour, but then the full psychedelic effects came on, and wow. I came out a few hours later just being like, what was that? Like, and I was totally fascinated from that point onwards. That first trip, I felt a real sense of, it was cosmic. It was a nighttime trip, a clear sky, the stars were out, and I felt this real sense of connectedness to the stars. I suppose I'd always wondered at that point, what is the point in the universe being as big as it is? since, you know, none of us are ever going to get to go to these places or see this stuff. And then I realized, oh, maybe that's not true that night. It's just, you're not going to do it by, you know, hopping on board a rocket. You're going to do it by going actually into your own mind. There are some interesting shortcuts in that direction. Yeah.
Totally, totally. And how would you, I'm curious how you would describe the difference between MDMA and like a psychedelic or this psychedelic to people that might not have experienced either one, or, you know, as a kind of comparison.
So MDMA is considered, or called an empathogen or entactogen. Its main qualities are a feeling of being high, of well-being, of pleasant bodily sensations, of increased empathy, often with desire to kind of touch and cuddle. It's the drug of choice at most raves and festivals. It's also now being investigated as an adjunct to psychotherapy, because it can really help people just relax into talking about or when talking about challenging issues. It's not considered a psychedelic usually. It's not one of the classical psychedelics, at least. In contrast, the classical psychedelics, what marks them out most obviously is this kind of visionary state. They induce this kind of dreamlike sense of reality with that very often includes visual effects, both with eyes open and eyes closed. At higher doses, the hallmark of the psychedelic experience is this sense of unity and interconnectedness, this overwhelming sense of all things being part of some greater whole. And I can't say I truly experienced on my very first trip. I think I got a hint at it, but subsequently I did have stronger trips where I have had this overwhelming sense of unity, and it's changed my life. Most people that I speak to that have had experiences with psychedelics do say is that it's something like that remains the most profound effect,
or
has made the greatest impact on them. Maybe you can relate to that.
Yeah, well, it brings to mind for me. I've been listening to, and we discussed this a little bit, but Michael Pollan, his new book, How to Change Your Mind, has really been blowing up in American culture, at least. Okay, great. And so I think it's really opened up a space of conversation. And one of the pieces that he keeps zeroing in on is this study around, I think it was end of life care for terminal cancer patients. Mm-hmm. I'm sure are very familiar with this, but that the experience that that eliminated most of the fear of death was this I forgot the exact term that he used or that they used in the study, but this kind of unification experience you seem to be talking about too. Yeah. Unitive. Yeah. And so is that largely, I mean, I guess from your perspective, is that mostly dose dependent?
Yes, very much.
Yeah,
so.
Okay.
This is not something you're ever going to get on a microdose of LSD. You know,
right. And so how long have you been doing the experiences in Amsterdam as part of the society's work?
They started about a year. January 2016 was the first trial one. Two and a half years now. And in that time, we've run around 20 weekends, and they're now happening every month. And they're soon going to be happening more than once a month. Yeah.
Okay, cool. And so this is really, I think, I'd love to spend some time just kind of playing in this space. You know, one of the pieces that Michael Pollan ends a lot of his interviews with is this call for new cultural forms, essentially, through which we can invite people into these experiences, right? Because really Michael Pollan says, it's not the substance that does the good work, it's the experience you have on the substance, which is a subtle but very significant difference, right? And maybe you can give us some context, right? Like what is the psychedelic experience like what tends to happen for people on it? Who tends to go? I'm just so curious just to hear more about what that is like.
Well, first, I absolutely agree that the psychedelics are often referred to as substances, but I think more usefully, perhaps they're thought of as experiences or practices, cultural practices. The substance is only one sort of element of all of these things. At the weekends, it's groups of 15 people. People make an application on the website beforehand, where we ask questions about their physical health and their mental health and their previous experience with various substances. And we're very careful in putting together the right group of people. At the moment, if people have complicated mental health conditions, then unfortunately they are turned down and referred to some of the studies that are going on at Johns Hopkins or Imperial and so on, because we're not trained mental health professionals. We make that clear. 15 people will meet on the Friday afternoon in Amsterdam, and we'll head back out to a venue, a large house in the countryside outside of Amsterdam. And we'll spend the Friday night cooking dinner together, having an opening circle where everyone says a bit about why they're there and what their interest in psychedelics is and what they hope to get out of the weekend. After dinner, we would play some simple games, do some simple exercises to help people feel further comfortable with one another. Then the Saturday daytime, we wake up and begin with some yoga and meditation. There's then another circle where if people have some intention for the trip, then they can express that intention. And the participants take the truffles around 11 a.m. by midday. As I said, a group of 15, and we have at least one facilitator for every three participants. So it's usually three facilitators, and they stay sober the entire time. They don't take any of the truffles. The facilitators are all very experienced with psychedelics, and with expertise in various other related techniques. They may be very dedicated meditators or experienced with yoga or breath work or other forms of body work, very knowledgeable about mushrooms or just whatever it might be. There's a range of things that of skills that the facilitators bring. It's a daytime trip. The trip lasts from between 4 and 6 hours, so from around midday to around 5-6 p.m. And during this time, there's a central space with music playing. It's a playlist that was specially designed by the team at Imperial College London for their studies with psilocybin. And that's the music is really very important. The music is really what's holding space.
What is the music in this case? Is it
it's
new agey or more classical?
All sorts. It's hugely varied, and that's part of the beauty of it. You can never quite tell what's coming next, but it is designed to evoke a wide range of emotion. It was designed for studies with people that may be suffering from depression and anxiety.
Is that on Spotify? Is that available? It was created
by a guy called Mendel Kalin, and he posts various mixes on his Mixcloud page. So if you search Mendel Kalin Mixcloud, you'll find some good stuff.
I'll put that in the show notes.
I should say, if anyone's thinking of coming on a psychedelic experience weekend, you might not want to listen to it, so you get the full surprise at the weekend. But we'll leave that up to you. But during this 4 to 6 hours, the facilitators are on hand to do everything and anything they can to make the participants feel safe and secure and happy. And I say happy. Of course, almost everyone has challenging parts of the trip. Very often there's real sadness and grief that comes out that the music might trigger. It's a sensitive skill on behalf of the facilitators to understand when someone's in going through a kind of a useful grief process, or if they're showing some real emotion, that actually it's best to kind of let someone really work with that and move through it, or perhaps when it's reached a point where maybe a hand on the shoulder and a cup of tea or something would be welcome at this point. And that's a skill that's developed over time and in the context of using these substances and sitting people that are using these substances. It's really a very subtle thing. What I can say is that we are getting brilliant feedback from these weekends. So I think we're doing something right. They truly are a labor of love. The Psychedelic Society, the organization that hosts and runs them, is a non-profit organization. We charge basically as little as we possibly can, and the facilitators are paid a very standard rate for their time. Everyone involved is doing this because we truly believe in the potential these substances for healing, for growth, for self-development. And it's a huge privilege to be involved in this program.
Yeah, wonderful. thank you for sharing all that. And there's a number of different directions that I would love to go in right now.
Can I ask you something first?
Yeah, please.
Which is, you mentioned a solo trip, or a trip where you were, you know, you had a couple of sitters around. But how much do you have experience of group psychedelic experiences?
Only I think with ayahuasca. Mm-hmm. Yeah, only with ayahuasca. I'm very interested in exploring it, but that's been the only really hyper intentional group context that I've used psychedelics in.
Yeah, it's interesting that if there were ever sort of traditional ways of using psilocybin mushrooms in Northern Europe, this knowledge has been lost, it seems. We've done some research and done some and been looking to see whether there are various traditions we can draw, and that's at the very least is nothing like as strong as the ayahuasca tradition in South America, where people claim there's been a kind of unbroken line of shamans for thousands of years potentially. So it is very much a case of sort of reinventing ritual, reinventing tradition with this psychedelic substance that grows natively, indigenously to Europe and North America, in most parts of the world, in fact. And that's a fascinating process to work out what psychedelic ritual does look like in the 21st century.
Yeah. And also a related question, which I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are, like, what is it for, right? I imagine that, you know, they had a certain conception of what these rituals were for in the cultural and social context throughout history that they appeared in, right? Like, they had a particular thing that people thought that these rituals achieved in like ancient Greece, right? That mm-hmm. that helped provide social order or something. What is the kind of thinking around that right now for you?
I think we are to ask what ritual is for might almost to be might sound quite backward to people of ancient Greece and many sort of ancient peoples, that I sense that in the past ritual was life, ritual was the purpose of life, ritual was for nothing beyond itself, and in fact the whole of the rest of life was gearing up to these, you know, to these feasts, these rituals, these ceremonies that in some sense made life worth living. It was the Eleusinian mysteries in Greece that I think you alluded to there, and this was a place just like sort of 10 miles north of Athens, where there's evidence that some psychedelic substance was used as part of a ritual that potentially thousands of people participated in each year and came from a long way to participate in. And as much as we understand, this was the recreation or acting out of a myth of an abduction of Persephone, and who was taken into the underworld by Hades and then eventually was allowed back up into the world of light. And it's a myth that represents the passing seasons, the very barren 4 months in Greece that it's too hot for anything to grow, and then finally the rains come and people, things start growing, people have food again. And I think that I have some sense that the loss of ritual and of course ritual often being connected to natural cycles and the natural world is of very great importance to the predicament we find ourselves in many ways.
Yeah, I have that same sense, and you know there is this. We have this common kind of philosophical orientation in the listening society and metamodernism, this sense of that the future of our civilization is to some degree bound up in the well-being of each individual human mm-hmm. and the collective of humans in general. And I'm curious if you have thoughts about what role these 21st century kind of psychedelic experiences might have in that sort of political project.
Yeah. I think that's true that the future is bound up in our connection to other humans. But I mean, in a meta-modern thinker might say all sentient beings and include, and that gets, you know, touches on what we were talking about before about appreciating cycles of the natural world and non-human beings as being fundamental to the well-being of all. But in terms of the human world and the world of politics, then yeah, there's some fascinating debate going on around this topic at the moment. So psychedelics, like meditation, actually have been shown in peer-reviewed studies to produce sustained and measurable increases in the personality domain of openness, which is one of the big, the big five, so-called big five personality attributes, and the big five being the kind of current leading model of personality that's statistically robust. This is interesting because there are very few techniques, very few practices that can cause persistent changes in these core personalities, base personality types, after around the age of 30. Mm-hmm. So that people have found psychedelics can do this is potentially very significant. The openness is a personality attribute correlated with tolerance, anti-correlated with prejudice and authoritarian behavior. For someone like me, I look at that and think, wow, fantastic. You know, if we can just get everyone to take these substances or engage in these practices and become more open and more tolerant, then, you know, job done in a way. But
which brings to mind the kind of let's spike the water supply, you know, kind of sensibility of the 60s. So just presence that and kind of keep, and but we're going to keep unfolding this. So it's not that, but let's acknowledge that.
I'm happy to put a note in there saying that a key part of the so-called psychedelic renaissance over these past years, in contrast to the 70s, is very much understanding the importance of the context of use of these substances. That no one suggests, no one even thinks for a second that, you know, something like putting LSD in the water supply would do any good at all, because we understand how important it is that these experiences happen under the care of or in places where people feel safe and feel prepared for the experience. So we fortunately moved on past that narrative of the summer and love and so on. Actually, what we can say is, they weren't all wrong. That this feeling, perhaps, that they had, and they didn't have as much science back at the time, that psychedelics would help people to become more open and more tolerant. Essentially, over the past years, yes, that, you know, that's proved that indeed is correct. but the interesting position we're in now, and you know, debate that's really only unfolding over the past months, is it's essentially to do with the network effects of this. Both of us, and we can use both of us as an example, that we both came to psychedelics through friends. If most people that come to take psychedelics are already to a certain degree open-minded and are being introduced to them by open-minded friends and so on, and then these substances further increase their openness, then there's a possibility, it seems to me and others, that actually we could have something of a kind of divergence of openness, of this personality attribute of openness in society, where the communities that are using these substances, you know, head in one direction, and but there are many people in the world that don't, you know, aren't meditating, don't use psychedelics don't have anyone that would introduce them to psychedelics, and so remain in potentially quite low in this trait of openness. And then I think that's a fascinating question. What does that look like? What does a world where you have this, you know, hyperdivergency in this personality domain look like? I'm curious for your thoughts on that. Do you think that's a realistic proposition, and where does that go?
Yeah, it's a fascinating and curious question for sure. I think the first thing that comes to mind for me is that to a certain degree that seems to already have and be happening. You know, they can correlate, at least in the US, I know, political party affiliation to trait openness. You know, Democrats being typically more open, conservatives, Republicans being less so. And there's also the phenomenon of creative cities and creative culture where people all move to Boulder, like I did, or San Francisco. You know, we self-segregate, and then in those self-segregated places, that divergence, I think, can even accelerate. Right, like if you're in San Francisco, you have access to all the kind of like proto-transhumanist tech and practices and meditation, and then the folks who stay in, you know, rural Kansas don't really see any of that. None of their friends are doing that because the friends that would have already left and gone to San Francisco, you know. So there's this kind of this fracturing and polarizing, and just thinking about it right now, it's a little frightening. Like what happens as that unfolds, I guess.
Maybe Trump happens potentially. You know, if you're saying this is already a phenomenon, but I suppose we can say, but it seems to me psychedelics still have some potential to do some good here, given that they and one angle, of course, is that they are. Also, and this actually, I think these things are related, a very promising treatment for depression and anxiety, and a very likely way in which psychedelics will first become available in Western societies is through medicalization in much the same way as cannabis. I mean, cannabis is an interesting example. Am I right, because of course it's still illegal in the UK, but am I right in thinking that in the US it's becoming more and more accepted, and more people maybe outside of the stereotype are starting to use this and starting to understand its benefits?
Definitely. Yeah, that is definitely happening. Yep.
Yeah. So I wonder if, you know, that it takes some time, but it's something that I think requires some thought about how or just some acknowledgement that in actually the short term this use of psychedelics amongst already open and liberal communities could potentially be making our situation worse. How do we get these substances or more generally practices to the people that might benefit from the most? And ultimately I do think it is benefit, you know, because it's tricky to suggest that I would want someone to take a psychedelic to change their political point of views. That isn't why I want them to take it. I want them to take it because I truly believe it can help people become happier, healthier human beings, with a more holistic and integrated view of the world. As a side effect, it may change their political views. I'm down with it on that basis.
Yeah, which is a similar kind of thing that might be said about something like meditation, right? And in fact, very similar kind of psychoactive effects of long-term meditation is that it makes you more open. One other piece I'll kind of throw into the mix is one of the other elements that Michael Pollan has been stressing is this idea of the brain as being a kind of balance between, I think he says, like entropy and order, right? And that some brains can become too rigid, essentially, too much order, and certain disorders arise from that. I think like perhaps depression and anxiety. And then there are obviously disorders on the other end of the spectrum, too much kind of openness or chaos or entropy. So instead that we want to kind of break down if you get too far over to one side or the other, which makes sense. You know, I see a lot of people in very liberal, open meditation, psychedelic world who, you know, could probably do with a week in a boot camp or a, really good personal productivity training or a week in a monastery, actually, to be honest. Yeah. Like you could spend some time in a monastery and it would help. It helped me to do that. And so there might be a more of a kind of conversational like appropriateness that might be emerging. Yeah. I don't know. How does that land or what does that bring up for you?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I mean, the monastery thing is interesting, right? Because when you're in the monastery, you most presumably, you know, there was a heavy dose of meditation. But yeah, I see what you mean. It was done in this like very structured way, presumably. I totally relate to this sense that sometimes some people, not least myself, could do with a week in a boot camp or something like it, and that this I'm not suggesting, and I don't think any either of us would, any metamodern thinker would suggest that there's one personality attribute to rule them all, that it very very much is about achieving balance in these things, but transcending, going beyond even this this very idea that the useful or the most useful way of describing human beings is in terms of an isolated individual with a certain set of numbers that describe how they function, and taking a more transpersonal perspective on this, that's fertile ground as well, for sure.
Totally. Yeah. And what brings to mind for me is that there's kind of, or that the pragmatist in me thinks, so there's a way in which I hope someday psychedelics might be used by modern culture. And then there's like now in the next 5 years, and the kind of context in which I imagine that they will be used or could be used, right? It won't be, I don't think, one of self-transcendence or, you know, just I want to have a more meaningful life. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. But it seems much more likely that it'll be a treatment for disorders, which could be very something that almost anybody in the modern world, you know, could self-prescribe themselves, like anxiety or depression.
There's some fascinating stuff here. First of all, the line between so-called medical use and recreational use and spiritual use is very blurry indeed. They can all be the same thing. It doesn't have to be the psychedelics as well. I believe that people taking MDMA and going to a rave, for example, could be both. People might first view it as recreational, but it could be medical, could be healing in some way for them, and they could have a kind of spiritual experience of connectedness with the other bodies moving in unison around them. So I think we have to be careful about drawing distinctions between these different methods of use. But yeah, as we mentioned earlier, this it's the sense of unity and interconnectedness that has been the most profound and lasting effect of psychedelic substances for me, and is actually it's inspired my interest in Eastern wisdom traditions, non-duality. I subsequently ended up attending the Science and Non-Duality Conference in California, which was a really fantastic week. Yeah, very important week for me. It's at best these practices entail a kind of natural empathy. If you truly see others, and that doesn't, it's human others and non-human others as yourself, then there's no question about whether you take care of that person or that thing. It's if you wake up in the morning and you're hungry, you don't consider biting your own finger off to satisfy your hunger. There's potentially something similar going on with these practices, that they can expand our sense of self and resolve questions, that in a previous worldview, individual egotistical worldview, seemed almost entirely insoluble. They kind of naturally resolve them sometimes in a way which beyond language. The ineffability of these experiences is another. Seen as another core part of them, but I find the ineffability interesting. I wonder whether that's simply the case that we don't have, or whether we may develop new language to describe these experiences over time if enough of us are using these experiences and paying close enough attention to them. A few weeks ago, I participated at study at Imperial College London, where I received intravenous DMT in an MRI scanner, and they're scanning brains whilst people have this very short sort of 4 or 5 minute DMT experience, and then as quickly as possible they take you out of the scanner and into an interview room and say, okay, what happened? What do you remember? And
now who did you talk to?
What did you meet? This kind of systematic research of these psychedelic visionary states that often seem truly like other worlds is only just beginning, and that I think is fascinating. We've had a decade of research on sort of the medical applications of psychedelics, but is there something beyond that? I think very probably there is, that psychedelics will become an area of just fascination and exploration and discovery for the human race in the decades to come, not simply a medical technique and so on. And that's I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I mean, I got like chills just hearing the idea of that possible future. And two things come to mind for me. One is that this idea that we might be able to kind of make effable that which is currently ineffable is, there's a degree to which that is proven out by like meditation, right? Like there's very sophisticated linguistic creations, essentially, or discoveries that people have made in terms of how to speak about these what seem like ineffable experiences. Obviously, you can't ever say them in a way that is the same as the experience itself, but you can start to really have useful conversations and kind of understand the physics and dynamics of it more. So that's one piece. And then the other thing that was just so striking in what you said is this idea that we might begin by using these substances to resolve things that appeared medical, but I think you said like were in fact discovered to be spiritual, and that the same might be true for politics, right? Like so many of the problems, so to speak, or the tensions we experience in the political realm, we think of them as political problems, but perhaps they're spiritual ones.
That really resonates with me. There's something quite zen about it, sometimes the solution is to walk in the other direction or look in the place you least expect for the answer in it. And it kind of feels that way for me with the political situations in both of our countries, at least, that it just feels that's more familiar with the situation with the UK in the UK at the moment with Brexit. It's just total stalemate. Like, no, the political life in the country is absolutely ground to a halt. And I think very probably it will take something from outside of the field as currently conceived to move things forward. And I think, and actually, yeah, and I think some of these, it could very well be some of these techniques and practices in ways that I don't, I can't fully anticipate yet, but it's there's power in them clearly, and it's they're spreading incredibly quickly is my sense as well. And one indicator of that is the amount at which they're discussed in some very popular podcasts like this one perhaps. but Tim Ferriss and Joe Rogan and Aubrey Marcus, and they're building up followings of hundreds of thousands, millions of listeners that talk very openly about these experiences. They've almost become like, you wouldn't know they were illegal, actually, the substances that were given, like given the frequency and casual nature in which they're now discussed amongst this certain community, at least. And that has an effect. There's a process of cultural normalization going on, and psychedelics and meditation as well. Meditation, for at various times and to various people, has probably been considered a bit of a kind of a weird thing to do, a bit of a waste of time, if you like. But these practices are just becoming something that, you find what works for you, and then you integrate it as part of your daily life, as part of your daily routine, because you understand that it makes you into a happier, healthier human. And by being that more developed individual, you can actually have an impact on the world around you. There's this increasing sense that it does start with us. And actually that speaks to some of Jordan Peterson's stuff as well, right? Like, tidy your own room first. And whilst I don't, I think he often sort of emphasizes that too much and moves too far in that direction by saying, you have to go to these really quite extreme degrees before you can even contemplate thinking about or talking about politics, which I don't think is right. I think there's something there. At what point will politicians start becoming questioned on their use of psychedelics and meditation and so on as a marker about whether they're suitable for office, not whether they're unsuitable, but whether they're suitable? And I think that day is actually not that far away.
I hope you're right. That is a beautiful thought, and one that I have not thought before, and I very much enjoy it. Yeah, that's amazing, and I think it's true. I mean, I do think it's generational, right? Like that you point to, like Aubrey Marcus and Tim Ferriss, and it's a certain demographic, at least in the U.S. It's a demographic that, at least in the United States, millennials are going to be the voting majority in 2020. Right. So I think we have yet to really reckon with the power of this demographic and their very different sensibilities around things like psychedelics, and all the contingent pieces therein. And it's very curious. I'll be very curious to see if that flip can happen. Yeah.
So, I mean, it seems you've had a bit of an impromptu coming out about psychedelics on this episode, actually. I'm curious, given the organization that I'm working with, I'm totally open about my use of these substances, but how does that work for you? Like, who do you talk to about these things, or what makes you feel comfortable talking about them?
Well, totally. And what has made me comfortable is to a certain degree, I think exactly what you said, that I have this local and non-local networks that I'm a part of, including people like Tim Ferriss and, my friend Vincent Horn, who started this podcast, Buddhist Geeks, has come out and said, this has been a big part of my growth journey. And just the kind of drip, drip, drip of more and more people saying, hey, yeah, this is a thing. This has been a part of my growth. You know, when you asked, I did a quick calculation in my head, I think, and just decided like, yeah, well, I mean, I talk about all kinds of crazy stuff on here. Like psychedelics is not even, in my mind, that controversial, mm-hmm. actually. Mm-hmm. Like the political stuff, I think, is much more controversial in a lot of respects.
Right.
And yeah, so, but then again, many people aren't in that kind of situation where they have social proof that they can look around and know that mm-hmm. even if some people reject them for that, that they'll still be safe, you know? And so I think also there's this idea that just if I share it, maybe one other person will also feel comfortable sharing it because I'll be that social proof for somebody else, and on and on and on, as part of this kind of, yeah, the sea change that is happening, this renaissance that is happening, if we want to call it that.
Yeah. I'll drop something new in, something else I've been very interested in reading about over the past weeks is the work of this chap, Jamie Wheel, on the Flow Genome Project, who's wrote this book Stealing Fire and is cataloging ecstatic states, and this has a lot in common with the so-called mystical spiritual type experience that you read a lot about in modern psychedelic literature, including in a lot of the scientific literature. But this definition of ecstatic states is, or flow states as he calls them also, is slightly broader still and includes things, yes, like meditation and psychedelics, but also like you know surfing and various, you know, athletic endeavors and pursuits of really being in the zone before a 100-meter race or whatever it might be, and sex and dance and so on. And I think that's where this is heading, really, like is towards a more holistic and integrated and broader understanding of ecstatic states as a whole. Where psychedelics will very soon, I think, be seen as not that interesting. And in a sense, I've sometimes told people my you know, the job of the psychedelic society is to make psychedelics boring, and to make they're just one more technique, one more practice that people use to achieve these kinds of ecstatic states. But these ecstatic states are recognized as real, intensely real, more real than real than you might say than most of waking life, and as a valuable, meaningful way to pursue, you know, to conduct one's life, and is to be in the pursuit of these, and that kind of makes me think back to the discussion on ritual, that there's most rituals, or the culmination of most rituals, is to reach some kind of ecstatic state, whether that's through you know, dance or drumming or chanting or whatever. And yeah, I hope the future is one of greater ritual, of greater ecstasy, and yes. Through these things, greater connection with the natural world. That seems to be like a good direction of travel for me.
Yeah, yeah. And in a sense, what you're talking about is a kind of even deeper secularization of these practices, right? That they become very humanistic and very like present in our world, our day-to-day world, in the same way that, like, you know, the Starhawks football team or practices meditation and uses mindfulness, and there's that level of normalization. And I guess how, this is a question that I would be very curious to hear your thoughts on, which is how could we fuck this up? You know, like, it does feel like we're on a good trajectory right now as far as normalization and legalization, but like, how is it that humanity is going to take a real wrong step?
Well, we've talked about the this divergence phenomenon, which I think we have to be mindful of and careful of. There's just the more basic stuff of not repeating the mistakes from the 70s and making sure that people do pay very close attention to the mindset with which they go into these experiences, the environment, the setting in which they take them, the dose at which they're using these substances. How else might we fuck it up? I think it's at the Psychedelic Society, we are offering these facilitated psychedelic experiences, but we work in close collaboration with the various universities, particularly in the UK, that are doing excellent psychedelic research. And our priority is not to do anything that would possibly jeopardize that research, because we still believe, whilst we think that these experiences can now be offered safely, it seems that the best path to the widest number of people having access to these substances is through medicalization, is through the FDA or European Medicines Agency's process. And I think anyone working with these substances, anyone, you know, or just even just anyone that takes them, enjoys taking them, would do well to have that in mind. It would only take a handful of people taking mushrooms or whatever, like they're picked themselves and using them in a reckless way that meant harm to themselves or others, that the media caught onto, that could really push this all back, make this very difficult. So I think anyone that is using these substances, and more generally anyone that is engaging in these practices, and I think for sure I don't think meditation is free of risks as well. You know, I've seen people that seem to be having sort of borderline psychotic episodes at the end of 10-day silent meditation retreats. But anyone that is engaged in these practices or, you know, is in communities of use should consider themselves as having a responsibility, not just to other people that are engaging in this practice, but to the world, quite frankly, to all the people that may not have used them yet, but stand to benefit and are waiting for them to be made available or be available in some way.
Yeah. And just to rediscover them in a new context that isn't scary or associated with the trauma of the 60s and all these pieces. Like, we have an opportunity now to kind of reweave these technologies into our cultural culture in a new way.
Reweave and combine, actually. I think Buddhist Geeks did something recently on sort of actually combining meditation and psychedelics, and there's a group in the UK called Cyberdelic that are combining VR and psychedelics.
Fascinating.
We're going to witness all sorts of fascinating combinations of these various technologies for ecstasy over the coming years, I'm sure.
Yeah, totally. And so just in case people are interested, one great episode to listen to from Buddhist Geeks is the one with Spring Washam, and she leads a combination ayahuasca and meditation retreats, and very fascinating exploration of the combination of those two technologies. And I guess on that note, like, so you mentioned Cyberdelics, that's the outfit in Europe. Are there any other spaces and people and places that you're paying particularly close attention to in the same way?
The first thing that came to mind is the Metta Monastery. An idea that I and others sort of dreamt up a few months ago, and we had one real life meeting about 20 of us in a location that seemed like it could be suitable. It didn't quite happen at the time, but there's some renewed interest in this idea from people within the metamodern movement. And I see, all indications are that the metamodern movement are understand the potential for these practices, including in combination to help people develop in the complexity of their thought, into developing their well-being, I would keep an eye on the metamodern movement for and any real life locations or events that come from that as spaces where you may find these various technologies being combined in interesting ways.
Right on. Yeah, and one other name that I'll drop is I think it's called the Astral Ship. I'm sure you must be familiar with.
Okay,
that they're also kind of and I think what I hear you pointing to is kind of creating new places of experimentation and kind of collaboration and group discovery that leverages technologies and combinations of technologies to perhaps even achieve particular goals, like create X or build Y. Or,
yeah. So the astral ship is in a church or a disused church in Wales, which. What does this look like at scale? Like, I mean, churches are being hugely underutilized. Like, the congregations of just a handful of people gathering in these huge and really beautiful spaces. At what point can we expect these spaces to be in use instead of places of true kind of ecstatic and spiritual experience, you know, distinguished from simply religious sermon, which has some value, but rarely causes people to actually be able to access these states that these other practices can take people to. When do we start seeing churches across the UK being used for psychedelic experience and meditation sessions and virtual reality and all sorts of different things that can take people or give people this experience of God, if you like? And that's, you know, that I very much think that God is an experience rather than something to be, you know, read about or heard about, and that these various, that at best, at peak, that is what these substances are giving us a taste of or showing us that we are identical with. And they are a tool for the re-spiritualization of society, which I think could very well be of very great importance in moving forwards.
Fantastic. Yeah. And I will, just to put a little bow on it, just say that perhaps God is an experience, but God is also much more than an experience. And God can be sermonized, but why not, if we can have access to him or her or it as an experience? Like, let's experience God that way too, you know? And so God is bigger than whatever container we put in it, whether it's experience or abstraction. Perhaps, but in any case, that vision is just so beautiful to me. It's one that I've actually had a number of times. All of these churches, even here in Boulder, that huge, beautiful buildings that increasingly look very empty. Somebody will have to do something with those spaces, and yeah, see who steps up to do something beautiful. Yeah. But in any case, Stephen, thank you so much for this conversation. I've learned a lot. It's been really deeply, deeply fascinating. And I've enjoyed getting to know you better. And thank you so much for joining me for this episode.
It's been a great pleasure. I'm looking forward to listening to future episodes and as they come on.